You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day, I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions, because you know I told you, and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a baller. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's podcast about the week in sports narrative. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. With me in the studio, Allison McCann, visual journalist for 538. Hi, Allison.
Hey, Chad.
And Neil Payne, sports writer for 538.
Hey, Chad.
Hello, Neil. Kate Fagan remains on book leave, but she's coming back very soon, maybe even in the next week or two.
Yay.
How should we welcome her back? What should the welcoming party be?
Well,
John Starks, life-size dolls or something
around
the studio? We should
have Starks here waiting in the wings. Like,
this is
your life. Like, she comes in, he jumps out and sort of, takes her through all of the things that happened on Hot Takedown while she was away, including the shrine that we erected to her over here in the corner.
Right. So you're saying John Starks has been listening to the last 2 months of Hot Takedown?
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Maybe Charles Oakley can escort him in. I think that would really make Kate say. So on today's show, the NFL playoffs are set, and the best teams may not have the best seeds. We'll explore how the playoffs got turned upside down, as well as whether this year was particularly deadly for coaches. And second, we know what analytics have done for big sports, but what could it mean for smaller sports? Jody Avergan and Carl Bialik will stop by to talk about Ultimate Frisbee and how the sport could benefit from a few more numbers and why it's so hard to make that happen. And then finally, we're going to do a super-sized significant digit. Neil has researched this thing like his generation depended on it. Are millennials ruining the NBA? All right, 12 teams remain in the race to the Super Bowl, but how many of them are actually decent? This year, more than others, the best teams from the regular season don't appear to be the best in the playoffs. Three of the four wildcard games feature teams that, according to Vegas, are underdogs despite playing at home. Which is not how this whole playoff seeding thing is supposed to work. The better teams are supposed to be the better seeded teams, theoretically, are supposed to be the favored teams. The roundtable over at Around the NFL agree that some of the lower seeds are their favorites this playoffs.
It's wide open. It's wide open every year, but this year it feels like it more than ever.
Pittsburgh can take the AFC. Who can we look at and say is absolutely going to stop them?
I look to the NFC's version of the Steelers. The team nobody wants to face is the Seahawks. Be afraid. NFC.
Be afraid of that swooshing sound, I say.
What was that?
It would be tough to tell.
It was the Seahawks zooming into the studio.
It would be tough to tell from that take that both the Seahawks and the Steelers are the six seeds in their respective conferences and that they're playing their first game on the road. But when you look at this field, it doesn't seem that crazy that those two teams are getting the hype that they are, right? Neil, when you look at ELO ratings and things like that, are these teams as good as they seem to be despite their seed?
Yeah, especially in the case of Seattle, who is the number six seed in the NFC. They are the number one overall team according to our ELO ratings, which is our method of ranking teams and figuring out their strength at any given time. And they finished either one or two at the end of last season and the year before that also. So this was sort of business as usual for Seattle, except that their record was not in line with what it had been in recent years, and that's why they ended up 10-6 only in the number six seed. Pittsburgh, a lot of people are talking them up. They don't have the best ELO rating. They finished the season in eighth place in ELO, but at the same time, they also were missing Ben Roethlisberger for big chunks of the season. They turned it on more late in the year, and that's kind of symbolic of the way that this playoff field seems to be, where a lot of the teams that were viewed as the elite teams or teams that had the opportunity to lock things up as we entered the stretch run. Like New England, they are not entering the playoffs on a particularly high note. Denver might have a brewing quarterback controversy on their hands. Arizona was blown out, even though they played, you know, their best players. They were not resting their starters against the aforementioned Seahawks. So this is a case where it really does seem sort of topsy-turvy, and that the records of teams and hence the seeding was not representative of perhaps the underlying talent of those teams, especially as they enter the playoffs right now.
So it seems like there's some validity to the Seahawks argument. Based on what Neil said, and they finished as league leaders in DVOA, which I was just reading about today over on Football Outsider. They've actually had four straight seasons on top of their ratings, so that this year puts them, I guess, right behind 2012 and 2013 Seahawks, but a bit ahead of 2014 Seahawks.
So, wow, so they were the number one team in 2012, 13, 14, and now 15.
Yeah. And DVOA is just what? It's just another ranking system, rating system?
Yeah, it's pretty much based on something that we talked about in stat school in the past, which is expected points added, sort of like on every given play, how much did you move toward scoring or preventing the other team from scoring? And they adjusted for strength of schedule too, which is another little wrinkle. But yeah it's pretty much like that.
For me, it was like helpful to understand, like, it was like how much a like 3 yard run is worth compared to like losing 8 yards on a throw or something, like trying to put some sort of value to every single play that could.
And a 3 yard run on, you know,
where
third
you are,
and
yeah.
two is good, on third and eight, not so good.
Yeah.
So yet the Panthers are still the favorites to win the Super Bowl, even though the Seahawks are number one 4 years running in DVOA and the top of our ELO ratings at 538. Why are the Panthers favorite then? Is it because they're playing it at home and home field really matters that much, or because they have fewer games to play because the Panthers get this bye week?
Yeah, it's mainly the second thing. Like, Seattle being on the road definitely is not good for them, but it's the fact that Seattle has to play at all in the first round, whereas Carolina gets that bye. That is the big thing, because, you know, it's another, since it's multiplicative, your odds of making the Super Bowl, having that other non-certain game to go through means that you're less likely just by definition. But Seattle, also being the number one team in ELO, if they do win this weekend, then I wouldn't be surprised if they were the favorites, the new favorites to win the Super Bowl.
And this gets back to what we talked about a lot with undefeated teams, where every game that you have to play is just a chance to not have the streak anymore, and in this case you need an undefeated streak in order to win the Super Bowl. But is there something about this year that the playoffs are upside down? Like, it seems strange to me that we're talking about six seeds. I mean, the Seahawks were 2-4 to start the season. Is it that we should we discount that? That is one question I have. And the other is there something going on in the league as a whole about injuries or about the strength of divisions because of the way that the playoff is structured that you guys can think of why we're in this situation in the first place?
Well, so certainly teams like New England was the team that was most hit by injuries during the season. You also saw Pittsburgh, like we said, with Roethlisberger,
and
Kansas
Cincinnati.
City. Cincinnati. These are teams that were expected to be good before the season, and they perhaps, you know, one of the factors that goes into them not having the record that was projected for them was because of the injuries. But then also, you know, it just was a year, like I said, where the performances of teams in terms of wins and losses don't reflect necessarily how they played in terms of even things that are like predictive stats, like point differential, or what Pro Football Reference has. It's called the simple rating system, which is just point differential adjusted for strength of schedule. You see, like, Seattle was second best in the NFC, and they were a full 3 points per game better than Carolina, even though Carolina won five more games than Seattle did. And you also see that in the AFC, where Pittsburgh and Kansas City were and Cincinnati led the AFC, but Kansas City and Pittsburgh, the 5 and the 6 seed, they're going to be on the road this weekend. They finished 2-3 in the conference in SRS, and New England and Denver were well below them, especially Denver, would be favored, or Kansas City would be favored by more than a field goal against them if you just looked at SRS. So it's just not reflective of the records that they had. And you can say, oh, well, you know, the teams that won, the, you know, had the better records found a way to win, and they know how to win, and they have a history of winning. But in the NFL, especially since it's such a small sample.
These are all good hot takes.
These are very hot takes. I'm generating the hot takes as we speak.
Yeah.
But yeah, since, you know, there's only 16 games in the regular season, something like point differential, especially if it's adjusted for strength of schedule, is more predictive than just straight up winning percentage. So it wouldn't be surprising to me if, like, the hot take that we heard those guys saying, that the lower seeds are the favorites, and if they, you know, especially if they win that first game.
And I remember back in October, Neil, you had wrote about how this NFL season was, like, so weird, and we even had a little episode on Hot Takedown. Do you think, in my opinion, it almost seems like things have become a little less weird. You know, teams have evened out. We said there was, like, only 10 teams that had winning records and stuff. So if anything, it seems like, I mean, it's still crazy, but, like, it has sort of rightened itself through the course of the rest of the season compared to back in October.
Yeah, I actually followed up with that and, like, looked at it yesterday, and it ended up, according to that metric, which was just looking at, like, the distribution of team records, like, oh, there were a lot more undefeated teams and a lot fewer, like, good but not great teams, and it just was weird through 6 weeks, I wanted to say. At the end of the season, it ended up being one of the most normal seasons on record. I think,
yeah,
it was second most non-weird according to that. But then now we have this situation, like we've been talking about this whole time, with just the teams that have certain records, perhaps they were not projected to have those records before the season, like Carolina and Seattle in the opposite direction, and then also that the underlying sort of fundamentals of each team are also a little bit out of whack with the records that they had. And I think that's why you're seeing this phenomenon of Vegas really going all in on these teams that just barely got into the playoffs, or they're not, you know, not even at home on the first weekend of the playoffs, much less having clinched to buy.
So at some point, I think Hot Takedown should cover, like, what, I think we talked about this before, what the ideal playoff structure should be. Like, mm-hmm. Should they be seeded by fundamentals as opposed to record? Is record so flawed that we, like, should disregard it when the playoffs come around? But real quick, Neil, before we start talking about coaches, come playoff time, do we know that the fundamentals of a team, these underlying stats, are more predictive of who's going to win the Super Bowl than whoever has a record and therefore the higher seed?
Yeah, I think they're more predictive. There was a run from, like, the late 80s through the mid 2000s where the team that had the most Pythagorean wins, which is another way of saying point differential, another nerdy, ridiculous way of saying point differential, won the Super Bowl at, like, a much higher clip than the team that had the most wins in a given season. And that has sort of turned around the mid 2000s when you started seeing teams like the New York Giants win from, you know, the wild card, and the Pittsburgh Steelers had a year like that too. But I think in general, if you just look at, like, the whole scope of the playoffs in the NFL, especially going back to 1990 when they expanded to the current 12-team setup, the fundamentals do a better job of predicting than just straight up record. But I think it's a combination of both. You know, you don't want to throw out the wins completely. And in a lot of cases, they are correlated. I just think this year is a situation where they're perhaps less correlated than they usually are.
Could you imagine, too, like, going into the playoffs, they're like, you won a lot of games this season,
but
your fundamentals, so you're going to go on the road.
You're going to have to win this next game by 75 points in order to get the number one seed.
So, but okay, sorry, I won't belabor this, but, like, sort of we say, instead of that, we say random chance is what makes you have to play on the road, because of a fluke play at the end of a fourth quarter in week 11 that happened to, like, be an interception off of a tipped pass or something like that. Like, it's... No matter what, instead we're allowing chance and fate to determine it, which maybe makes for more exciting television, more scintillating debates on around the NFL roundtable. But, like, no matter what, you're emphasizing and prioritizing a system that is going to upset somebody and have some unfairness in it, aren't you?
Right, but I think winning and losing is what sort of the bedrock
you play
of the
to
whole
win
thing.
The
you
game.
Play, yeah, it's in our or at least it should be in our intro if it's not. So yeah, I think there's something that, like, would be deeply unsatisfying about having wins and losses not determine who makes the playoffs or where they're seated. And also, I mean, even if we're using, say, we have perfect knowledge of who the best teams are and we seed according to that, we, you know, if it could be that by some chance, you know, a team that didn't make the playoffs, but we in our omniscience know that they should be in the playoffs and should be a high seed. Even then, if we sort of set them down and set the wheels in motion and just say, play the games out, you're not going to have that team that we omnisciently know is number one going into the playoffs win the Super Bowl as often as perhaps we would hope. That team, you know, will lose, and that's another thing of just a single elimination tournament in a playoff structure is going to give you some random results. And also, you know, there could be just something about the playoffs that we don't necessarily – we're not able to pick up, or the regular season doesn't tell us about. Maybe a style of play. Maybe it's the fact that it's colder. You know, that was always the theory when the Patriots were rattling off their wins, was just like, oh, well, Peyton Manning is a great regular season quarterback, especially when he gets to play indoors in Indianapolis. But then once you get outdoors and it's cold in New England, Tom Brady is the, you know, has the ability to do it. But I mean, that is also probably a BS narrative also. So there's just, it's such a small sample that we don't know that much, and we're just trying to fit narratives onto what we do know.
So real quick about what we do know, I want to get to the coaches who have been fired or asked to leave or
politely.
Yes, exactly. There are six coaches who started the season but did not end it. Tom Coughlin, Mike Pettine, Jim Tomsula, Chip Kelly, Ken Whisenhunt, and Joe Philbin. Has this been a particularly grisly year for coaches? It seems like about four were let go on the final day of the season or the day after. Neil, do we have numbers around whether Black Monday or whatever it's called in the NFL was particularly dark?
Yeah, Black Monday didn't strike me as being that much different. If anything, it seemed a little bit less violent than in the past. But we went back and we looked just at like overall coach mortality rates, if we're going on with this death metaphor for their coaching tenures. Very dark. And so, like you said, 6 out of the 32 teams fired their coach either during the season or immediately after the season in a lot of cases. And that's 19% of the league. And if you go back to 1992, which was when I had full data, you could go back further if you wanted to. I did not have the data on hand this morning. But you will find that exactly 19% of teams in that span fired their coaches. So we're like right par for the course. And what's really interesting is if you go back from 2014 to 2010, it was a lot higher. 22% of teams fired their coaches last year, and in 2010 it was 25%. 2012, 28% fired their coaches. So we were seeing this period of a lot of action on the chopping block, and so maybe that's why 2015 seemed sort of tame by comparison, but it's possible that that stretch from 2010 to 2014 was also just outside the norms, because the year before it started in 2009, only 9%, 3 of the 32 coaches were fired. So it's pretty much normal, I would say.
Okay.
What went down in 96? The dark ages. 30% of coaches were fired that year.
Right, a third of the league was just baby face and fresh.
So sad.
All right, let's leave it there and move on to where the real action is. When 538 hired Jody Avergan, one of Hot Takedown's producers, he accepted the gig on one condition: that we let him fly to London a few months later to coach the U.S. men's under-23 Ultimate Frisbee team at the World Championships. Our other colleague, Carl Bialik, caught wind, went to visit Jody at the tournament, and saw a sport in the dark ages of analytics. We brought them both on to talk about it and what it might say about the analytics divide in sports, which is a term that might not exist, but I think is telling. Carl, Jody, welcome back to the show.
I just want to be clear. Yeah. I had the coaching gig before I took the job at 538. You guys didn't fly me to London. Just in case anyone...
Before you fled to London. Yeah. To
but nevertheless, our respective pieces do signal the first in the slow march towards turning 538 into our personal Frisbee blog.
Okay, so Carl, you went to this tournament. What did you see when you were there vis-a-vis analytics and how it was working within the sport?
I saw people playing and coaching the sport who could match up with probably the best minds in analytics and other sports, but they were lacking the raw materials that you need, which is the data. If you look at what's in a typical box score now for like our major U.S. sports and even some minor ones, it just dwarfs what you'd find at an ultimate tournament. It also varies by tournament. Sometimes it's not archived on the web. Sometimes it's just, you know, hanging up on paper somewhere. And so there isn't really enough data for any one tournament, and then enough data across the whole world of Ultimate to really dig into it deeply like we see with other sports.
You wrote, too, that Jody actually had to, like, track by hand while coaching and then, like, have your clipboard and be, like, writing down who scored a point or did something, which I find insanely difficult to do while also, like, thinking about a game and changes you're going to make and then be like, wait, who was that? I mean, do you feel like you probably just miss half the things that happen in a game?
Yeah, I mean, I think the tools, like the literal tools of like, there's no good app to do this. So when you're tracking, like as a coach who's been coaching for a long time and then as a player and a captain, you know, it's like the best way to keep the stats that we have is like a graph paper and a clipboard, and you just, you know, come up with your own little system. And of course, trying to then feed that into some database that could be shared across teams is incredibly hard. But then it's also like the nature of the game itself makes it really hard to keep stats. And so, you know, for people who have not seen the game played, it's very free flowing. It's kind of like a mix between soccer and football and basketball with a disc, but you know, it, I think it faces a lot of Ultimate faces a lot of those same challenges that those free flowing sports face, which is like the most concrete unit of like of that you can measure, which is like a score. It really doesn't tell the story of who contributed on a given point, who's sort of who's being the most effective. So it's like there's these twin challenges I think about with Ultimate, which is like we don't have the language and the tools and the data points to collect, but even beyond that, it's just a hard sport to collect data around.
Yeah, like even if you had perfect manpower to kind of track everything that you wanted to, are there things that just like you wouldn't be able to know because of the free-flowing nature and like parceling out credit? How difficult is it to parcel out credit to a given player on a given play?
Yeah, I mean, even a really ambitious effort would probably be mostly focused on the disc, but sort of like in football or soccer, you have lots of people off the ball, you have lots of people off the disc, and tracking all of that, tracking the throw that wasn't made because the defender was just locking down her player, that's really, really tough to measure. I mean, I visited the summer before in London, the people who do this for soccer, and there's a lot more money in it for soccer. It's still really labor intensive and they're still missing a lot. So Opta does a great job, but
I mean, I think the soccer parallel is a big one. And Allison, I'm curious, you know, if stats were used when they talk to you as a top level soccer player, but like sometimes I watch soccer. I mean, I remember watching the World Cup the last time I was on and watching Pirlo from Italy. And like that dude basically ran probably like 20 yards the entire game. He just like stands in place and then like the ball comes to him and he distributes it somewhere else. But he's like the most effective player on the field. But it's like, how do you actually measure what he's doing? And there is equivalent to that. And ultimately, I think that's kind of the player that I am, which is just kind of like you're doing a lot of the little things right and you're greasing the wheels, but you're not doing the splashy things that show up in the big metrics.
Yeah, absolutely. I think like we've had a few hot takedowns about just the difficulty with also measuring soccer is varies so much by position and by type of play that a team plays. Like they talk about that all the time, that the style of play, like if you're someone that plays very direct and you don't pass a lot in a game and then your stats say like something, they only did 7 passes in that game. Well, we play a direct style versus I think the nature of soccer is really interesting in that I know all sports have styles, but I feel like soccer has, especially by country and by league and stuff, is just so different. So it's really hard to get these sort of universal stats that can work well across everyone.
So who's supposed to keep track? Who's supposed to do this? I mean, this is not a sport with a lot of money in it. The broader organizing power, I'm sure, exists. There's some disc association, Jody.
Yeah, there's 2 pro leagues now, and then there's a sort of governing body for the club circuit, which is still kind of the most dominant circuit. And then at the college level, it's very sophisticated for the top teams, but it's money. I mean, that's where I come down on it. Is that, you know, If a lot of money showed up, people would find a way to use it towards analytics. But right now, the reverse incentive, which is the most, you know, which is usually the path, which is like, oh, this thing is actually making money and it's popular enough that it's making money, so now let's throw some money at it. That has not started to happen yet.
So part of the fun of writing this in the early days of 538 becoming an ultimate Frisbee analytics site is we hear from a lot of people after we write it telling us about things that we didn't know in great detail about necessarily before. So, you know, Jody mentioned there are 2 pro leagues. You might call them semi-pro leagues. And we heard from people in both of them. And they are already doing some pretty interesting things with stats. They're doing different things from each other. Not every team is necessarily doing the same thing. So this gets to the problem. But one of the people we heard from mentioned something interesting, which is this could actually generate more money. That one of the ways that sports that have big breaks between play, as Ultimate does between points, one of the ways they keep people interested on TV is they have interesting graphics on the screen. So maybe one way to make Ultimate more TV friendly is you could have like a great heat map of where teams are scoring from or who's completed the most passes. So I think people are thinking this way about it, but it's just a question of will they get together on the same page and will this be a priority with all the other things the sport needs to focus on?
And you guys mentioned that like you talked to multiple people from multiple teams. Is there like a community and a sense of collaboration? I remember in the early days of like NBA analytics, people who worked for teams, even if they were competitors with each other, would get together on like message boards and almost like trade ideas or bounce ideas off each other. Is it in that stage? Is there a sense of community there among the people that are developing things? Or
I think so. I think it's a small enough community right now. I don't think anyone's going to hoard their data, though there are these two semi-pro teams, leagues that I don't know how much they're sharing with it. But also there is, you know, there is a kind of community sharing element to Ultimate's DNA anyway. You know, it's got these sort of hippie roots, even though it's kind of moved well past that at this point. So I imagine the community is going to work together at this point. It will be really interesting to see like the first moment someone has like a lot of money and a data set and refuses to share. I think that'll lead to some interesting moments.
One of the other U.S. coaches who I spoke to in London who's really into this topic wants to have a conference, wants to get everyone together. So I think there's no kind of cultural barrier to sharing. It's more just logistical. But I think if there were a conference and if people could kind of video in from around the world, and of course we'd live blog it on our Ultimate Frisbee blog. I think that really would drive innovation and standardization, and it would be exciting maybe to even people who aren't as diehard as Jody and I are.
Jody took issue with this, Carl, but you wrote it's also popular among engineers, computer scientists, and mathematicians, which I was like, this seems like the ripest group for people to be tracking, you know, if, I don't know, like the teams could somehow organize some sort of like when you're out, you're the stat guy for 5 minutes type thing. I think
it is the sport is generally simpatico with those kinds of people because the sport has tended up until very recently to kind of flourish at colleges, and so you end up with a lot of engineer types and so forth. Silicon Valley has, like, you know, there's a bunch of great Ultimate played in the San Francisco area. So yes, I think that, Carl, you wrote this, and I think it's right that there are a lot of people who have these kinds of analytical minds who already interested in Ultimate.
So what's the future? How far out are we for Ultimate? And is this maybe the ripest of the smaller sports that aren't at prime time because it is gaining popularity and does have a pretty big base of amateur players through colleges? Is this a ripe place for us to find out what happens when analytics come to a smaller sport, and how many years is it going to take for us to get those heat map graphics or whatever else?
I think that's a really interesting question. As a coach, you know, I'm hoping, you know, maybe in the next world championship I have a little bit more, and then maybe a few world championships from now I'm really able to like go to a player and make a case to sort of coach them through analytics. You know, you're most effective from this part of the field, so we really want to find ways to run plays for you on this side of the field. Ultimate is really one of the fastest growing sports in the world. I think the its peer sports like lacrosse and rugby are probably going through a lot of these same questions right now, but I don't know. What's your prediction, Carl?
I'm pretty optimistic about Ultimate relative to other sports partly because of the cultural aspect we talked about and the university roots. It's pretty young. And part of what might help it from having somewhat fractured structure is that there are a lot of different groups trying different things. So maybe now it's healthy that there are different paths. And if they do end up having a conference or some way of connecting, maybe they can figure out a way to make this stick.
What's I guess I think about this with women's sports sometimes too, is like what are three most like baseline stats that you would like to have? Like for soccer, I think about, I would like to just see possession and shots on goal. And, you know, one other thing that I'm not getting advanced stats, but if I can just get three things or something. So what would be the simplest, yeah, you know, actually helpful? Like you had said, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, like field position, I think is really interesting to me. I mean, we're at the point now where the kind of tidbits of stats that we've had, the tastes of them, are starting to like mostly reinforce things that we've intuited. So like in ultimate, you know, how effective is a team when they're stuck on the sideline versus in the middle of the field? If we can back that up with stats, I think it would make a huge difference. How valuable is it to like throw a lot of little passes and keep possession versus take one long shot and hope for the best, even though it's a lower percentage? But that field position stuff is really interesting to me, and I could see implementing that as a coach.
Just one quick one, because you can actually do it pretty simply now, just with knowing who's on the field when, would be some kind of adjusted plus minus. We see this in a lot of field sports. How good is the team when you're on the field versus not, controlling for who else is on the field? And that isn't that far away from reality and would be really useful.
Okay, you can read both Carl and Jody's pieces. There were two on the Ultimate Frisbee blog, 538.com.
Two of
the first two of many.
Yeah.
Yes, and we'll be sure to link to them from the Hot Takedown page, which we're mercifully allowing to exist even in this new Ultimate Frisbee era. Thanks, guys, for coming on.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Moving on now to our significant digit, where we get a number from the world of sports that tells us something that we wouldn't have known otherwise. Allison McCann, you bring us our significant digit every week. What do you have for us this week?
Normally I do, but this was a very special significant digit to Neil, so I'm going to let him take it this week.
To all of us, really. We all fit true. This description. But this week's sig dig is 97%. That is the percentage of league-wide value created by the NBA's millennials, members of the millennial generation. And the genesis of this idea was Robert Sarver, the owner of the Phoenix Suns. He's not happy about the way his team started the season. And in his mind, one of the big culprits is the millennial generation. He said a couple days ago, "My whole view of the millennial culture is that they have a tough time dealing with setbacks. And Markieff Morris is the perfect example. He had a setback with his brother this offseason, and he can't seem to recover from it." So Markieff Morris is a player on the Suns. His brother Marcus was traded to the Pistons last July, and Markieff reportedly also wants to leave Phoenix, and so he's been kind of having this unhappy stint with the team. So Sarver sees this and thinks, oh, the millennials are, you know, it's happening, you know, it's creating locker room dysfunction and also hurting the team, and it's just a symptom of what's happening in society.
Can I just interrupt and say that Sarver saying this suggests that he is not okay with setbacks.
Yeah,
that he has trouble dealing with setbacks, given that he's lashing out in this way. If you believe this is a lashing out.
Trying to be constructive, mm-hmm. But we thought we would also be constructive to him and perhaps teach him a little thing or two about millennials in the NBA. And so one of the first things, like I had mentioned at the top of the segment, if you think that millennials are just ruining the NBA, I have news for you that 97% of the value in the entire league is created by people who were born between 1981 and 1998, which is the Wikipedia definition, at least the average definition, using a bunch of different cutoffs of a millennial. And we have a chart here for those who are watching on the internet. That we show the sort of the rise of the millennial generation in the NBA. It starts out in the year 2001, the first year that any value was created by someone born between those years. It's risen steadily ever since, and it has reached nearly 100%, and it's been close to there for near about five seasons now.
So, okay, can we just pause to a couple like clarificatory definitional things? That's a lot of years that a millennial encompasses. Allison, does that feel like the right span to you?
We did. We had a group meeting here before. We all identified as millennials. I think we thought maybe the upper cutoff would be a little bit closer, but we're giving the average of the Wikipedia definitions, I believe, right, Neil?
Yeah, and the earliest that they mentioned was 1980. And the latest that they mentioned for the start of it was, I believe, like 1983 or 84. So pretty a lot of agreement for the beginning of the generation. There's some disagreement as to when it ended.
But that sort of doesn't matter for this,
it doesn't
right?
matter because for the NBA, because the youngest player in the NBA right now was born in 1996. And the mean cutoff, according to the definitions that you see at Wikipedia, is 1998.
Okay.
So everyone who was born in 1981 or after is, for our purposes, considered a millennial.
All right, so really, we feel good about 97% of the NBA, of the value, of the player value in the NBA, being driven by a bunch of young kids who can't deal with setbacks.
They just can't deal with setbacks. Yeah.
Okay.
And we also looked for teams that were the most millennial, and perhaps not surprisingly, given this 97% figure, 100% of the value on the vast overwhelming majority of the league is created by millennials, including the Golden State Warriors, who are on track to be one of the best, if not the best, team of all time. They 100% of their value.
They haven't
created
had
by
any
millennials.
Setbacks, though. That's why they're
they haven't handled the
if
setback.
If they have
because,
a setback, then
exactly,
they won't be
yeah.
able to.
And perhaps it's telling that Houston is one of the teams that is not 100% millennial because they have had some setbacks this season. But Phoenix, also 100% of their value created by millennials this season. So it's really the exception.
So if he gets rid of all their millennials,
there's no team. What is, an what incredibly is left? Old team and probably be a horrible team.
The least millennial team is Dallas.
Yes.
Is that because of Nowitzki?
I think Dirk Nowitzki, who is, I believe, the leading non-millennial in terms of value this season. He's 37 years old, so he just missed the cutoff. He perhaps is single-handedly carrying Dallas's non-millennial contingent this season. But we also were thinking about, like, well, okay, so the NBA is a closed system within a certain season, at least. And we can't really say, like, oh, well, even though there's 97% of the league is millennial, perhaps it's a worse game. Perhaps all of these millennials in the league have potentially poisoned it.
It's an unwatchable product with all those kids running around.
That's right. So first of all, we looked at, like, measures that were sort of subjective about how good the product that the league is putting out there. First of all, is the league less popular than it was in the past with all of these millennials entering the league? So we turned to our friend Google Trends to see if relative to the other big four sports leagues, that's the NHL, Major League Baseball, and the NFL, if people are searching for the NBA less with the influx of these crazy, annoying kids into the league, perhaps the league's popularity has gone down.
Can I just read the sub-headline of this chart for those who are not watching on 538.com? Because it's really – it's bringing statistical analysis to something that I think needed statistical analysis. NBA Google Trends Index first percentage of non-negative VORP produced by millennial players 2004 through 2016.
Yeah, you gotta zero out those negative VORP players to get a proper percentage. But we see that there is really not much of a trend in terms of, you know, the more millennials, the slightly more that people are searching for NBA related topics relative to other sports, but really it hasn't. The point is that it hasn't had a negative impact. It's really the NBA's popularity is the same as it was when Google Trends first hit the scene in 2004, as it is now, even with all of this influx of all of the millennials in. And another way of looking at that, another angle, is to just look at, like, the Nielsen ratings and see if the popularity of the product has gone down that way. So we looked at the NBA Finals Nielsen ratings, and we also saw that there was a slight positive trend that as more millennials have entered the league, the game's biggest stage has been watched by more people. But then we thought, oh, well, you know, that's just people watching it. But what about the underlying core quality of the players in the league? So I was like, we can take this further. So
it hasn't gone far enough.
Hasn't gone far enough. Our boss, Nate Silver, when he was working on – he was working for Baseball Prospectus. He was part of this book called Baseball Between the Numbers, and he did this thing of, like, well, how do I compare Babe Ruth to Barry Bonds on an absolute scale? Well, you have to take into account park factors and league factors and all the things that we talked about in a stat school long, long ago. But he was also like, what about quality of competition? Well, you know, Babe Ruth played against players who were probably inferior to today's players, but how do I quantify it? So he went through this incredibly convoluted process in which he took pairs of seasons where the same player played in both leagues in back-to-back years. And if a player hit better, for instance, in the second year than the first year, then it stands to reason that it would actually be easier to be a hitter in the second year than the first year after you take into account things like aging effects, because it's the same player. You've adjusted for his aging process, and if he finds it easier to hit, then the quality of his competition has gone down. And the same is true in the inverse, where if he finds it harder to hit, then the pitching quality has gone up. So we did the same thing for the NBA. We used a stat called box plus minus, which is the best predictor among box score stats, which can go back into the 70s, of how a team will do. I think it's the best box score metric, and we'll probably have a stat school on that at some point in the future too. But we did the time machine method, Nate's time machine method on that too. And we got this arc of how the absolute quality of play in the NBA has changed over time. And it makes sense. So starting, we started with the year 1977, the first year that the merger had taken place in the NBA with the ABA. And you can see, for those watching, the curve goes upward pretty steadily through the mid to late 80s as, you know, Bird and Magic and Jordan hit the scene, and the league's quality really goes up since the 70s, when it was sort of the Wild West with the ABA, and you know, teams were still trying to get a handle on how to play. Now, then they started expanding. And as expansion players come in, the league's quality goes down. And it continues to go down through the 90s and through the year that the last expansion takes place in 2005 with the Charlotte Bobcats.
As those pre-millennials run up and down the court.
Pre-millennials are still dominating at this point, I'll be careful to point out. And only around 2005 does it turn back again, and it starts becoming a higher quality league. And to this point, right now in 2016, we're at the same point of quality roughly that we were in the early to mid 90s, or perhaps right after the NBA-ABA merger. That's a very long-winded way of saying that if we zoom in on just the years that the millennials have been in the league, you can see a pretty positive correlation between the percentage of league value that's created by millennials and the absolute quality of play in the league. More millennials means a better NBA. We have scientifically proven it. And so Robert Sarver perhaps is not acquainted with these numbers. If he's blaming all of the ills of the league on millennials, he should know that most of the league is millennials now, and it's a better absolute product in terms of player quality than it was before they entered the league, and therefore we have taken down his hot take with Matt.
Whoa.
I feel like we have to do a recap.
that was virtuosic. It just seems evident. I mean, just in the strength of the amount of effort you put into this, that he must be wrong.
Let me see if I can distill this in succinctly all of Neil's genius teachings. So the league is basically entirely millennials.
Mm-hmm.
This hasn't made the league less popular, the mm-hmm. fact that it is all millennials. And in fact, the quality of play in the league is better.
Yes.
Those are the take-home
bullet points.
And Nate invented a time machine.
Yes. And I've adapted it to the NBA, I suppose.
Bob Sarver, email us, podcast@538.com. We'll be happy to walk you through it. We got the charts. Listeners, if you want to see the charts that Neil was wildly gesticulating at as he proved Bob Sarver wrong, go to 538.com. You can see them there. Wow, I think that was a sig dig for the ages. Thanks, Neil.
Sure thing.
All right, that'll do it for this week's show. Thanks to Allison McCann.
Thank you.
Neil, you get a second thank you.
Ah, thanks, Chad.
Our podcast producer this week was Jody Avergan. Joe Sykes will be back next week. Our video producer is Ryan Nantel. We got production assistance from Tony Chow. You can email us at podcast@538.com, even if your name isn't Bob Sarver. To those of you who emailed us saying that last week's podcast cut out in the middle, thank you for those notes. If you want to hear the end of that stat school and you weren't able to, you can delete it off your phone and re-download it. We were able to fix it quickly, but not quite quickly enough for all. So email us. We'd love to hear what you think about this week's show. Even if it doesn't cut out in the middle, hopefully it will not. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're also on iTunes. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. Be sure to review and rate the show while you're there. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.